8:13 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. After interviewing applicants for vacancies on the Summit County Mosquito Abatement District at noon tomorrow, the Summit County Council will reconvene at 3:30 at the Summit County Courthouse. In the studio with Preview, I have County Manager Tom Fisher. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So at 3:45, the quarterly budget update from Matt Levitt. He's reporting that there's not much information for the first quarter of the year, but he does say that the transient room tax is partly due to the changing distribution formula with the Chamber Bureau.
Well, certainly the way that it's split and how much the county retains will change and go up slightly because of that. I think the other thing that we've noticed with transient room tax with the Airbnbs of the world and all the other types of nightly rental type businesses, we're seeing more revenue from that because now they're all required to remit different types of sales taxes, including transit room tax. So that's one of the reasons we're seeing an increase in that revenue.
Okay. So is this kind of the third and final year of that transition?
Yeah. So as the chamber transitions to their next budget year, which will be that June to July timeframe, that's when the last change will be made.
So how much money are we talking about?
So, you know, if we're collecting $11 million total, 70% of that approximately will be retained by the chamber, with the 30% going to the county.
Okay. And then where does the county plan to spend that?
Well, right now we've used some of that in the past for different types of grant programs, like helping the city of Oakley advance some of their trail planning plans. But we're still expecting to see some proposals on some larger projects here in the near future.
That you can't talk about.
I can't talk about them. I mean, I think the community knows that generally there's been some work around future convention centers. That's one possibility. But the fund itself is fairly restricted in how it can be used, but it has to be used for something that would increase or promote tourism. So that's where we'll be focused.
Okay. Well, and some of that money I know was set aside for the fair, and we're just done with the first phase of that fair master plan, right?
Yeah. So the county has invested approximately about $5.3 million in the fairgrounds over the past 5 years. We've got a little bit more work to do on a project that didn't get completed last year that we'll try and get done before the fair this year. The council has not looked at further investment in that. We're kind of waiting for, we're going to be reauthorizing or putting in front of the voters this year the reauthorization of the Recreation Arts and Parks tax, which will also most likely have a bonding component for some recreation projects that could advance projects at the fairgrounds as well as other communities around the county. So we're kind of looking at those things before we commit the TRT.
All right. The close of the state legislature, just a couple of days away.
Always an exciting time.
Yeah. Deputy County Manager Jana Young gave us a nice summary last Friday of the bills that you're keeping an eye on. Do we have any updates on, say, that MIDA bill?
No. The only thing that I know of with the MIDA bill is that the author has been receptive to some of the language changes that we've wanted and that UAC has supported. So we're just monitoring that to make sure as it goes in front of the for final votes that it stays that way. I haven't had any updates. Usually I don't get those until late Tuesday morning. So
okay. Let's see, at 4:50 then tomorrow, a discussion regarding COVID-19. The PowerPoint in the staff packet basically looks like the presentation that Health Department Director Rich Bulla gave to the Health Board at its meeting last week. As Rich observed then, the situation constantly changing, the state again reporting a second case just this morning. At this point, though, we haven't seen a community case. I mean, it seems like it's coming from
cruise
ships or.
Well, I mean, I don't have the particulars on the case that has just been reported. Mm-hmm. I heard it about 30 minutes before I heard it from you on the radio this morning. So, you know, each case is going to tell us a different story, and the public health folks are going to change their advice based on that. So we're just waiting for the information, just like everybody else is, in order to see what we need to do. What Rich is continuing to do, and the health department is continuing to do, is to educate as many people as we can about how we can work to help prevent community spread if it does come to Summit County, and to provide some perspective if we do get cases here, what might happen, how those will be treated, and then how will our community continue to prepare and react to that. And that goes to everything from talking to the school districts to talking to private businesses, putting up best practices from how this has been dealt with over the last few months by other countries or other states, and even internally, how we're talking about this with our employees, how we're changing the way we clean our buildings, those types of things in order to prepare.
Yeah. Is the county thinking that it could possibly have a remote off-site workforce?
Well, you know, it's very difficult when you're a service-based entity, in order to do that. Plus, we have, approximately half to three quarters of our workforce is hourly. So you have a lot of complexities involved with a workforce for anybody, in how you deal with these situations. So, I don't think it's anybody's desire that we start curtailing operations of local governments. I don't know what the threshold would be for that, but we are starting to talk about what the different scenarios would be based on how widespread something becomes.
So what are you kind of hearing from the public? What's the mood?
I think it's a lot of different things. You hear the dichotomies. You hear those that are saying that, it's way overblown and we shouldn't worry about it, to, we should be preparing for being in our homes for 90 days without any contact. I don't know where this is going to go. I don't think anybody does. I think the best thing that our health department is promoting is that right now we don't know, and we just need to stay up to date on what's happening.
All right. At this point, is the county considering holding some kind of town hall to field questions?
Well, I mean, our health department has been out meeting with many different groups. And also, they're a very small group of people. Those that deal with this directly within our health department are probably about five or six people, including the director and the deputy director. So we really have to rely on getting the information out to other folks in the community and allowing them to pass it on, dealing with their own organizations. That's really the role of public health in this.
All right. Just anything else on the agenda that you wanted to mention?
Not specifically on the agenda, except that we have it's always nice when we have an ag preservation coming in. And we've got about 330 acres on several parcels owned by a family in the Camas Valley along Democrat Alley that are wanting to change into that zone, self-designated so that they can protect their way of life in agriculture.
All right. Does that give them entitlement then into some kind of tax?
It's not necessarily an entitlement. It's not necessarily related to tax. It's really related to state law in how, as other development might happen around them, that they're protected from any nuisance complaints, that they can continue their agriculture operations.
All right. Do they get then, does it then become greenbelt in terms of tax?
I don't believe it has anything to do with the assessment on that property. They're probably already qualified for greenbelt based on their agricultural activity.
Okay. Wanted to ask you, lots of work underway at the roundabout again. Huge piles of dirt and things. What's happening?
Well, they're ramping up for their final push into the spring and summer to finish up those projects. One of the large things that they still have to they really haven't gotten very far on. They're just been doing underground utilities over the winter. Is the replacement of the park and ride that's going to be out there? So that's probably one of the things you're seeing as well. There's all of the tunnel work that will complete the trail between the north side and the south side of the roundabouts, and that's the major activity right now.
All right. Also wanted to ask your reaction to last week's Joint Transit Summit.
Sure. So, you know, the main thing that I got out of it is that I think staff has a pretty clear picture of where we're going to go with how we're going to move forward with continuing our current operations for a period of time as the county gets into advancing what regional transit will be in the future. Don't know what the outcome of that is going to be yet, but we're already talking to our partners in Wasatch County to start figuring out what are our first planning steps around transit. What does a future organization look like that will manage that? You know, a lot of things that take a lot of discussion up front so that we make sure that all parties get a voice in that.
All right. Well, Park City declaring that the transit system is stretched to the limit, and at least one council member thinks that talk of regional transit really an attempt to intrude on the city's land use authority. So will this rewritten operating agreement make a difference in those philosophical differences?
I think we'll probably solidify what those philosophical differences might be or clarify them from the standpoint of moving them from that philosophy into policy. And if that's where the whole councils want to go, we'll take it from there. I mean, I think the other takeaway here is that we're always going to be connected. We cannot not be connected. Whether we're, you know, the county with partners are running a regional system outside in the unincorporated county and into other counties, and the city or ourselves are running those connector routes in and out, and of course the city system. All of that needs to connect, and we need to do it in a way that makes sense to accomplish the goal of mitigating congestion.
So I think we did hear that, both sides interested in maintaining the system. The county, though, wants to see a different system. Does that mean, though, that you take the $8.5 million that you've been putting into the current system and start building the transit system that you want
to
see?
Well, somewhat. It's not that simple. There's revenues in there that we have agreements on in how we're going to share those. And largely those have been put towards routes like the Express that cross jurisdictional boundaries. So we have to maintain those because those are important to moving people in and out of our communities.
And that was my kind of question here. I mean, if money is pulled out of the system, where does those cuts happen? We certainly want to make sure that we still have transit to the Ecker Park.
I don't look at it as cuts necessarily. What I could envision is perhaps what if we with Wasatch County and other partners started to build a regional system, does Park City continue to run the brown and the pink and the green, which are generally county routes, or does the regional system do that? It would be a transfer of funds. It wouldn't be necessarily a cut in service. Those things would still exist in some form or another.
So how much does the county have budgeted for transportation?
Our overall budget that Caroline Rodriguez manages is just over $13 million. The money that goes into the transit system or our ILA with Park City is just a part of that. We do other things with that revenue, that total revenue and total expenditure beyond what our relationship with Park City Transit is.
So what happens next? I mean, we'll see this revised in a local agreement?
Yes. So at our next JTAB meeting, I'm expecting the draft ILA as the staff has worked on it up until this point to be discussed, to be viewed, see where, if that's adequate for what JTAB feels their charge is at this point. And then, you know, we might have to react to some of those things that came up during the joint meeting to see if there's any additions that have to be made to that.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to add on that?
Just that both planning commissions are recruiting right now. We have some open spots, those close on the 18th at 5 p.m. And then our library board is also recruiting. Same date, the 18th at 5 p.m.
All right, Tom, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
That's Summit County Manager Tom Fisher. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. Coming up now on 8:30, Good Morning, with the Park City Planning Commission meeting Wednesday, 5:30 at the Marsac Building. Joining us with a preview, Park City Planning Director Bruce Erickson. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
The Planning Commission will consider an item in the Alice Claim subdivision, a conditional use permit for a retaining wall that's greater than 6 feet tall. The Planning Commission has a whole work session scheduled for it. It seems like we've done this before. What's at issue here?
Well, we have done it before. And excuse me, and there's actually two items on the work session this evening. One's a land management code change. But at the Alice Claim, you know, we went through a decade of controversy on that particular project. And there were some compromises made during that discussion where people were concerned about the project and this and that and the other. In this particular case, we have a letter from the engineer stating that the wall was preliminarily constructed in the wrong location. And so it's growing from the 6 feet to approximately 9 feet. The trees that were supposed to be protected remain protected. We've been on site to take a look at the situation. I think this is going to be a policy discussion for the Planning Commission about whether or not this sort of discrepancy in action makes the intersection better or worse. The applicant has two options. He can either put the wall back where it was approved, or the Planning Commission can take an action to allow this additional geometry.
How did the applicant mess it up?
Well, surveying is a weird business sometimes, and it depends on where you start from and where you finish. And in this particular case, I won't go into the details, but it was surveyed on a radial, which means it was surveyed on a curve instead of a straight line. And that's kind of a technical difficulty, but in this case, it was probably not the project, excuse me, not the whole project application that was at fault. There was a discrepancy in the survey.
So does the survey company become liable for any, I mean, are there any penalties for building outside what was allowed?
No, that's why we're back in front of the Planning Commission. The Planning Commission has the right to say, yep, this is okay, we'll change it. We've slowed them down now till we get an application answer. Or the Planning Commission say, no, put it back where it's supposed to be. They need to make a policy decision about what's best for the neighborhood.
So what's the staff's recommendation?
At this point, staff is not making a recommendation. We're listening to the Planning Commission and seeing which way they want to go. The engineer has made comments in the staff report. The city engineer has kind of a different job. And from his perspective, and the applicant has submitted some information, that the turning radius and the geometry of the corner is actually better with the wall pulled back.
All right, let's see. The Planning Commission will also have a work session on nightly rentals. Talk to us a little bit about the city's goals for moving nightly rentals into resort-adjacent neighborhoods.
Actually, it's the reverse, Leslie. The HRL zone, excuse me, I'm sorry. The HRL zone on the east side of historic district does not allow nightly rentals at this point. On the west side, which is on the hillside of of King Road and Daly, does allow conditional uses for nightly rentals. And that happened when that rezone was created. So now we're having a conversation about whether that's still a good idea to allow for nightly rentals on those streets that are pretty steep and narrow. And so we're going to have a conversation with the Planning Commission about that.
So I know what does the city have power in doing? I mean, I know that the state legislature has kind of leaned in favor of nightly rentals.
We have local land use authority. And so we can make this zone change if we choose to. That's part of the power that's granted to us as a municipality. And so if the local residents and the rest of the community decide that nightly rentals are no longer a good idea on the west side of the historic district, then we'll go ahead and move that forward.
So that basically would ban them. Is that what you're saying?
Well, yeah, that basically would no longer allow for additional affordable housing.
Yeah.
nightly rental.
Rental. But in the winter, I can understand that being an issue. In the summer, that snow is not a, a problem.
No, but the steepness of the roads are a problem. Management of noise and parking continues to be a problem. You know, we have a series of summer events now. Our zoning regulations for nightly rentals did not necessarily consider the change in how nightly rentals are managed, where you go to instead of a regular person renting their house for 2 weeks while they go on vacation to a house that's put into a rental pool year-round through Airbnb or Vrbo or whatever you want it to be. That's a completely different operation. And in almost all the zones, nightly rentals are pretty much allowed, but they're not allowed to be commercial uses. And that definition of commercial is a very subtle question that the Planning Commission is going to have to address.
And I guess, you know, people have purchased, I mean, spent millions of dollars on units that they thought that they would have a rental income from. I mean, is there...
Yeah, I mean, people are making money off the town. That's exactly right. And these are investment-based discussions. People are saying, yes, I can make a lot of money if I want to do this. To some degree, nightly rentals take available units out of other housing opportunities. And so the Planning Commission is going to have to weigh nightly rentals versus longer-term rentals for other people. There's a couple things going on here.
Yeah. I mean, do you think that you could find yourself in a lawsuit, though?
Oh, sure. Yeah, that's pretty normal. We can at least find ourselves in an appeal situation on this one. I think that's why we're having a work session conversation and deciding where the framework is for how we move forward, protect our neighborhoods, protect the investment discussions, make sure we're delivering housing where we can and not distorting the market.
Okay, well, we'll probably see that at next year's legislative session. The Deercrest Club wants to expand the St. Regis to accommodate about 100 more members. So what kind of impacts would this expansion have?
Well, this is another difficult conversation that we're having with Deercrest. If you look at the fact-based data that Deercrest has submitted, the general public would not notice the change. You know, there's a small number of members that go to the club on any one basis. The traffic report suggests that the traffic is going to be minimal. It rarely fills up the club. There's a question that the Planning Commission needs to address about how the club was originally approved and how we approved the original conditional use permit to open up the club to the public. So it's a complicated conversation. I don't know that I could give you an idea of the outcome at this point.
Planning commissioners expressed an interest in being able to talk about their goals for projects in the land management code outside the time set aside for specific action items on agenda. So what sort of issues do they want a deeper dive on, and when is that going to happen?
We're trying to work our way through that one right now, Leslie. The Planning Commission has taken a position that they want to be a little bit more stronger in long-range land use planning. Our position as the planning department is that's fine. We're happy to do that for you. But you cannot do this without appropriate research. You just don't get to go off anecdotal evidence. You need to do the research. You need to let the planning commission do the research and give you technically correct options that you can discuss. So that's coming forward. We're trying to figure out how to make that work operationally. This is not a normal Planning Commission operational procedure. This is a progressive situation, and we're trying to work with it.
Let's see. The first open house on the redevelopment of the parking lots there at the base of Park City Mountain Resort was held last night. That was something you did not attend?
No, I did not attend it.
For
right now, the planning director needs to kind of maintain some distance from what the applicant is saying. There were some staff members in attendance, but in order to make sure we have impartiality and I'm reviewing the documents correctly, I'm staying out of the conversation.
So where do people get more information as they kind of launch this plan? I mean, is the application online at this point?
There's two sets of information, and I need to verify for you, Leslie. The planning staff has the capability of taking input, and they have the application in the office. The applicant has agreed to prepare the website and maintain the data for the application. I don't believe that that's been completed at this point. It should be completed this week, and I'll just have to follow up.
Okay, but it's multi-hundreds of pages?
It is definitely multi-hundreds of pages. Planner Aneth has two boxes of application sets under her desk at this point.
Okay, so somebody could come by the planning office
and scroll
through it.
Absolutely.
Okay, anything else you want to mention?
No, just the other thing that's on the agenda tonight, we're just going to continue it for right now. The Silver Mountain Spa has gone through a subdivision process where we cleaned up some old lots a couple of weeks ago. They've also made a request for a rezone from residential development to general commercial, which is probably, depending on what the Planning Commission says, probably going to be acceptable for the Silver Mountain Spa itself. There's a piece of property in the back that's currently used for parking that they want to rezone as well and then ultimately redevelop. So we're working through that at this point.
Okay, Bruce, thanks.
Thanks.
It's Park City Planning Director Bruce Erickson. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. KPCW News Time now 8:43. Well, coming up later this month, March 26, and then on PBS next month, the film Bedlam will be shown. It's a film about the national crisis surrounding the care of our seriously mental ill. The filmmaker is also a doctor, Kenneth Paul Rosenberg. He joins me now on the phone. Good morning, and thanks for being with us.
Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, so tell us, why did you want to make this film?
Well, I'm an addiction psychiatrist. I treat people for chemical and behavioral addictions. But I became a psychiatrist because my sister has schizophrenia. And I decided at the age of 14, when she was 20, the age when these psychotic illnesses hit, that I would become a psychiatrist, went to medical school, become a psychiatrist. In medical school, I was bored as heck with medical school because I went to become a psychiatrist. I started studying film in medical school as well, and they were very kind to let me do that. But cut to the current reason why I made the film. I've made a whole bunch of films, 4 films for HBO, 2 for PBS, but never really dealt with what I consider one of the major social crises of our time, which is how we as a culture and how we as a profession in psychiatry have abandoned our sickest, our neediest patients, those people with schizophrenia, those people with serious bipolar disorder, those people who have what we call serious mental disorders, serious mental illnesses. And I decided in 2012 that that's just about the most important thing I could do with my time and decided then to make the film.
Yeah, so apparently it was filmed over 5 years. Do you follow the same people through that time?
Yeah, I mean, I started making the film in an emergency room at the epicenter of the crisis in Los Angeles, the busiest emergency room in the country, at LACUSC, LA County Hospital, University of Southern California Hospital. And in that emergency room, I filmed many people, but followed just a few of them, because it became apparent that in the emergency room, you saw the crisis, you saw the epicenter of the crisis, but you didn't really see the tragedy and trajectory of the experience of the illness. You didn't see the families and how they struggled for better or for worse. And I decided that to do that, you would really have to follow people over the course of time. And because I have a good day job, I'm a doctor, I have a luxury of time. So I was able to, you know, take my time and make this film over many years.
So the title of the film, Bedlam, it comes from the name, I understand, of the institutions of where we used to care for our mentally ill. We no longer have those institutions. Is that a good thing, or has it resulted in the increasing numbers of homeless that we see?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, Bedlam is an institution that still exists. It's outside of London. It was originally called Lady of Bethlehem, or Bethlehem Hospital, developed in the 1200s and then became a psychiatric facility sometime in the 13th, 1400s. And it still exists in some form. It is a very good psychiatric hospital, but the name Bedlam, nickname for the locale, is now, of course, synonymous with chaos or mayhem and has come to be known as a way of, you know, shorthanding madness. Now, we had many institutions like that. They built those institutions in Europe, and then they built them in America in the 1800s. And they were built with the best of intentions. I mean, they were monuments to enlightenment and good care, but then they soon became symbols of disgrace, really, by the 1940s, 50s. And then we got rid of those, as you alluded to. That was the move of deinstitutionalization, getting people out of the asylums, and hopefully, as President Kennedy said at the time in 1963, into the welcoming arms of the community. Well, in fact, the welcoming arms were not there. They ended up into the unprepared arms of the streets, of the jails. The jails today are our current asylums. So deinstitutionalization was, in theory, a good idea, get people out of the dreadful asylums and into better community mental health centers and outpatient clinics. It wasn't executed that well because the community mental health centers were not prepared to deal with the sickest patients. They didn't do a very good job of it. And then it wasn't well funded. And by the time President Reagan came along, they were defunded. So through the years, we've ended up not deinstitutionalizing people, but transinstitutionalizing people, taking them from the asylums of yesteryear and onto today's streets and into today's jails.
Yeah. Are we seeing more incidents of mentally ill, or are we doing it? I mean, certainly we've got more people, so you would think more cases of that. Or are we just doing a better job of mental, you know, of just, you know, diagnosing mental illness? I mean, or is there something going on that we are just creating more mentally, you know, sick people?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. It's not an easy question. I mean, you know, by and large, a certain percentage of the population, 1 or 2% develop schizophrenia, 4% develop serious mental illness, cross-cultural, it doesn't matter what they're exposed to or what they do. But we are doing some things that are making that worse. First thing we're doing is we're not treating people. We're not treating people early. We don't have a universal health care system, which, regardless of your political beliefs, for people with serious mental illness, that would be a good thing. They would get treated early and effectively. An early intervention in any disease, particularly a serious mental illness, is a good thing. We also have an epidemic of drugs. About 80% of the street population are using, if not abusing, street drugs and alcohol. That's not a good thing for anyone, I would say, but particularly if you have a serious mental illness. We have poverty. We have many social ills. We have a housing crisis in major cities. Which means that if you are functioning poorly, you end up on the streets. So we're not creating mental illness per se, but I think we're certainly making the vulnerability much worse. And with drugs and poverty and repeated trauma, and even I would say with structural racism, we're opening a window on serious mental illness that might otherwise be closed for a number of people in our community.
Yeah. Are you feeling hopeful about the situation after, I mean, again, putting a big chunk of, you know, 5 years of your life into this?
Yes. I'm feeling very hopeful. I mean, the film was shown at Sundance, which is very hopeful and shocking sign, pleasantly shocking, I should say. It's also was the only film they've shown about serious mental illness in some time, if ever, which I think is a good, you know, a good sign as well. I think we're at a watershed moment for this. We've had some major legislation over the past 10 years, the Parity Act that was enacted in 2010, which means that mental illnesses should get treated and reimbursed on par with medical illnesses. The 21st Century Cures Act, which enables you know, greater parity and really encourages people to get treated in outpatient clinics and not in emergency rooms. I think there'll be more legislation, but I think the most hopeful thing, which we document in the PBS film that will be on April 13th, the most hopeful thing is the rise of activism. And one of the people we follow, just by serendipity, his sister, of the four people we follow, his sister became one of the world's foremost mental health activists, and we chronicle her journey as a mental health activist. I think that will change things. We see that in other diseases, in HIV, cardiovascular disease. Breast cancer is a very good example. Because of activism, the diseases are now not great diseases to have. There's no great diseases to have, but they're far more manageable and more optimistic. And the prognosis is far better today than it was 20, 30 years ago.
All right.
Because of activism.
Yeah. Presented with Connect Summit County as part of the Real Community Series with Park City Film, Bedlam will be screened here locally at the Jim Sani Auditorium, 7 p.m. on Thursday, March 26. A post-film discussion with Dr. Howard Weeks, professor of psychiatry at the University Utah School of Medicine, and Amber McKay, executive director of the Summit County Clubhouse, again, will be held afterwards. And again, if you do miss the free screening here locally, you can see it on PBS April 13th, 8 p.m. Mountain Time, pbs.org for more information. Appreciate you spending some time with us.
Always great to be back in Park City.
Okay. That's Dr. Kenneth Paul Rosenberg again about his film, Bedlam. It's 8:53. Good morning. Well, estate planning, what you should know, is the topic of tomorrow's free lunch and learn at the PC Mark. Attorney Natalie Siegel will be leading the discussion. She joins us now in the studio. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So maybe just start, what kind of information are you going to be presenting? I mean, talking a little bit about the probate system and...
Yes, I'm going to talk about the probate process. I'm also going to talk about documents that I think most people should have. Really, there are kind of two sets of documents. There are the documents that apply to you when you're living, but you may be incapacitated. And then there are those documents that provide what happens to all of your assets when you die. So we kind of go through the whole process and discuss those types of documents. And also, it's an opportunity for people that have documents to come and just hear some general things about estate planning, and maybe it's time for you to review your documents. So,
okay,
open to everyone.
So you're talking about wills, medical directives,
yes,
trusts,
yes, and financial powers of attorney. Yes.
Okay. So, does everybody need a will?
Yes, I believe that everyone needs a will if they would like to designate who their heirs are and say who their heirs are and where they want their assets to go upon their death. If those matters are important to you, then I think a will is an appropriate document for you to have.
And at what point do you start thinking about a trust?
Well, it really depends on the situation, the family situation, and it also depends on the assets. There are some things under Utah law now that allow you to transfer real property without a trust. There are types of deeds that allow you to do that. So it really is a fact-dependent situation based on the family. And sometimes people want trust, Leslie, because they want to provide for minor children and they want their children to get assets at certain ages. So that's a great reason to have a trust, not making it so that when your child turns 18, he or she gets a lot of money. You might want to spread that over a period of time. So that would be a really important reason to have a trust.
All right. And then you mentioned power of attorney. I mean, who do you give that to?
Well, really, you give it to someone that you would trust with your financial and healthcare decisions. So I think the most important form out of all of the forms that I'll talk about tomorrow, the most important document is the Utah Advanced Healthcare Directive form. And that's the medical power of attorney in the state of Utah. That incorporates a power of attorney and a living will. And that is your direction to medical care providers, telling them what you do and do not want done in case you're at an end-of-life situation. And you can make that decision for yourself, and you can also name a person that would make that decision for you. So if you name an agent to make that decision for you, you want to make sure that person knows what you do and do not want.
Yeah. Who knows who has that power if somebody becomes incapacitated?
Well, what I tell my clients is that you need to take that power of attorney and take it to your primary care physician. And I know Intermountain Health and University of Utah, they will scan that form in. A lot of times when you're going in for a procedure now, those agencies, those healthcare providers ask you if you have that healthcare power of attorney. It's a form, so sometimes they'll even provide it for you. It doesn't need to be notarized. It just needs to be witnessed. So I know the healthcare system in Utah, they're really looking for that form, and they want to make sure people have it. I think it's, like I said, the most important document that anyone 18 years and older can have. I wish that they'd give it to you when you renew your driver's license. So I will be going over that form tomorrow as well.
Okay. Well, assisted suicide, not legal in Utah.
No.
But what if someone doesn't want to live with a debilitating disease or condition? Is it very clear in the directive that if they don't want to live like that, that their power of attorney can take them somewhere where that can happen?
Really, there's a section in the healthcare directive that gives direction as if they have a certain condition, if they are in an, there really are five end of life situations that the Utah legislature, along with the Utah Medical Association, has taken a look at these five scenarios to say, these are the end of life situations, and yes, you can in the directive say, I do not want to prolong my life artificially. So what you will always get is hospice, and you will always have pain, comfort care, so pain medication, but anything artificial, you can ask that to be withdrawn. And this form designates that.
Okay. So again, people, because what you really want to do is avoid probate. You don't want to get into that mess of working within the court system.
Right. I mean, probate is a legal process. I mean, it's a proceeding. You have to file with the court. There is an informal probate process in Utah, supposedly set up for the layperson, but most of the time attorneys are needed to draft the pleadings. And, I talk about the probate process. Like I said, there's an informal procedure. As long as no one is contesting anything, you can really follow that. But it does take some time, and it becomes public. So if you want to avoid that, I will go over tomorrow. I will go over the documents you need to avoid that process.
Okay. Again, that's happening tomorrow at the PC Mark between 12 and noon. A lot to get through, I know.
Yeah, and it's free. And I'm going to talk for a short period of time and then open it up to questions.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. Anything else you want to mention?
That is it. Thank you so much.
Natalie, thank you.
Okay.
That's local attorney Natalie Siegel again. State planning, what you should know, tomorrow at the free Lunch and Learn. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW.